Bicatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome back, everyone, to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling a really big one, a book that fundamentally reshaped how we think about life's history. We're diving into Wonderful Life by Stephen Jay Gould.
That's right. It's all centered on the fossils of the Burgess Shale, these incredible remains from, what, 500 million years ago?
Exactly. And Gould uses them to ask this, well, profound question. Are we human beings the inevitable result of evolution, or are we more like cosmic lottery winners?
It's a fascinating question.
Yeah.
And Gould's answer really turns the traditional view on its head. He argues pretty convincingly, I think, that the history of life isn't some predictable climb up a ladder towards us.
No, not at all. He paints a picture that's much more chaotic, much more random, ruled by chance, contingency, sheer luck.
Which is humbling, to say the least.
Yeah.
It challenges that ingrained idea that humans were somehow destined to arrive.
Definitely makes you rethink our place in the grand scheme of things. So who was Stephen Jay Gould? He's the one who brought this radical idea to a huge audience.
Well, he was a giant in 20th century science, wasn't he? A paleontologist, evolutionary biologist, professor at Harvard, and just a brilliant writer. He could make complex science accessible, even poetic.
He really could. And he wasn't just reporting on fossils. He had his own major theoretical contributions. Punctuated equilibrium, for instance.
Right. That's key to understanding his perspective. He developed that with Niles Eldridge, the idea that evolution isn't always slow and steady.
Uh-huh. It often happens in fits and starts, right? Long periods where things don't change much, then bam, rapid bursts of change.
Exactly. Stasis punctuated by rapid change. And if that's how evolution works, the idea of a smooth, inevitable progression towards complexity or toward humans starts to look, well, a bit shaky.
So that background really positioned him perfectly to look at something like the Burgess Shale fossils and see something others had missed.
It absolutely did. His theoretical framework gave him the lens to appreciate just how revolutionary those fossils really were.
Okay, let's get to the heart of Wonderful Life. The core concept is contingency. What does Gould mean by that in this context?
Contingency basically means that history is incredibly sensitive to initial conditions and random events. It's not predetermined. It could have gone a completely different way at any number of points.
He uses that famous thought experiment, doesn't he? Replaying life's tape.
Yeah, that's the one. Imagine you could rewind the history of life back to just before the Cambrian explosion, this huge diversification event.
And then press play again. Let it all unfold from the same starting point.
Would you get humans again? Would you get anything remotely like us? Gould's answer is a resounding probably not.
Like vanishingly unlikely.
Pretty much. He argues that the specific chain of events, the specific environmental shifts, the specific extinctions that allowed our lineage to survive and thrive, it was just one pathway out of countless possibilities. We're an accident of history, a glorious accident maybe, but an accident nonetheless.
And the evidence for this, the real world proof, comes from those Burgess Shale fossils found way up in the Canadian Rockies.
That's the case study. Because these fossils, around 505 million years old, they capture this moment of incredible evolutionary experimentation, a riot of different body plans.
A biological lottery, as you said earlier.
Exactly. And the shocking conclusion Gould draws is that the lineages that survived the subsequent mass extinctions, including the one that eventually led to us, didn't necessarily survive because they were better or more advanced.
It was more about being in the right place at the right time, or just dumb luck.
A lot of it was probably just dumb luck. Surviving a mass extinction isn't always about fitness in the normal sense. It's about whether your particular adaptations happen to work in the radically changed conditions, or if you just happen to live somewhere less affected.
Right.
We are, in a very real sense, the descendants of the lucky ones.
Which makes the story of how these fossils were initially understood even more fascinating. They were found back in 1909, right, by Charles Doolittle Walcott.
Yeah, Walcott, a major figure, head of the Smithsonian. He found this incredible deposit, but he didn't quite see what he had.
Why not? What did he miss?
Well, he was working within the dominant scientific framework of his time. People expected evolution to look like a cone of increasing diversity, starting simple and branching out, becoming progressively more complex and diverse, leading towards modern forms.
So he had this expectation.
Exactly. And when he found these truly bizarre, alien-looking creatures in the Burgess Shale, his brain essentially tried to make them fit the pattern. He interpreted them as primitive ancestors of groups we know today.
So he'd find something totally weird and say, oh, that's just an early type of crab, or That's a primitive worm.
Pretty much. He shoehorned them into existing boxes.
Yeah.
He couldn't really conceive that these might represent fundamentally different ways of building an animal, blueprints that just don't exist anymore.
It's a classic example of how our preconceptions can shape what we see, or rather what we don't see.
Absolutely. His theoretical bias blinded him to the revolutionary nature of his own discovery. And because of that, the true significance of the Burgess Shale lay dormant, hidden in museum drawers for like 70 years.
Incredible. Until the 1970s, when a new team took a fresh look.
Ah, yes. The Cambridge Group. Hmm. Harry Whittington and his students, Iman Conway Morris and Derek Briggs. They're the heroes of the story in many ways. They meticulously re-examined Walcott's fossils without those earlier preconceptions.
And what did they find?
They unveiled this lost world. A Cambrian explosion that wasn't just producing more species, but radically different kinds of animals. These weird wonders, as Gould called them.
Okay, give us some examples. I know there's some famous ones.
Oh, definitely. You absolutely have to mention Opabinia. Picture this. A creature with five eyes on stalks.
Five eyes.
Five eyes. And a long, flexible nozzle coming out the front, ending in a grasping claw. It was apparently so strange that when Whittington first presented the reconstruction at a scientific meeting, the audience literally laughed. They thought it had to be a joke.
Wow. Okay, what else?
Then there's Anomalocaris. The name means unlike shrimp or weird shrimp. This thing was the apex predator, maybe up to a meter long, which was huge for the time.
A meter long Cambrian predator.
Yeah, and it was so bizarre that its different body parts had initially been identified by Walcott and others as three completely separate creatures. Its circular mouth was thought to be a jellyfish, its feeding arms were mistaken for shrimp bodies, and parts of its main body were classified as a sea cucumber relative.
That's amazing. Putting that jigsaw puzzle back together must have been incredible work.
It really was. And then there's Hallucigenia. My name says it all right. It was so weird. They initially reconstructed it upside down and backwards. They thought its defensive spines were legs it walked on, and the actual legs were tentacles on its back.
You couldn't make this stuff up.
You really couldn't.
Yeah.
And the fact that these creatures are so hard to classify, so unlike anything alive today, leads directly to Gould's really crucial distinction between disparity and diversity.
Right. Let's unpack that because it's central to his argument. Disparity versus diversity.
Okay, so diversity is basically just the number of species. How many different types of beetles are there, for example? That's diversity.
Got it.
Disparity is about how fundamentally different the body plans are. Think about the major architectural blueprints for animal life, the phyla. You know, having a backbone like us vertebrates, having an exoskeleton like insects and crabs, having a shell like snails. Those represent high disparity, big differences in basic design.
So lots of different ways to be an animal.
Exactly. And what the Burgess Shale showed, Gould argued, is that the Cambrian explosion wasn't just an explosion of species diversity, it was an explosion of disparity. There were likely more fundamental body plans, more basic ways of constructing an animal alive 500 million years ago than there are today.
Wait, so life's history isn't a story of ever-increasing fundamental designs? It peaked early.
That's the radical claim. Maximum disparity early on, followed by massive extinction, a decimation event that wiped out most of those experimental blueprints purely by chance.
So evolution since then has mostly been tinkering, working within the few surviving body plans.
Largely, yes. Refining and diversifying within the lucky surviving lineages like arthropods, mollusks, and our own group, the chordates. But not inventing fundamentally new ways of being an animal on the same scale as the Cambrian. The period of radical experimentation was early, and much of it was lost.
Which brings us to our own ancestor, or at least a relative from that time, Pikaia.
Ah, Pikaia, yes. Yeah. The humble little worm-like creature that might be one of the earliest chordates known from the Burgess Shale.
It doesn't sound very impressive compared to Anomalocaris or Opabinia.
Not at all. It was small, unassuming. But it had a notochord, that stiffening rod, that's a precursor to the backbone.
Yeah.
It represents the potential root of the lineage that leads to fish, amphibians, reptiles, birds, mammals.
And it was just one design among many, many others back then.
Exactly. It wasn't obviously superior. It wasn't destined to win. Its survival through the subsequent extinction events was, according to Gould, purely contingent. A matter of luck.
If Pikaia or something like it hadn't squeaked through that lottery,
then the entire history of vertebrates, including humans, might never have happened. Our existence hinges on the improbable survival of this tiny, seemingly insignificant creature. It's the ultimate example of contingency in action.
That's a powerful thought. Let's maybe pull back and summarize some of the big themes Gould draws from all this.
Okay. Theme number one, obviously, is contingency rules. History isn't on rails. It's unpredictable. Small events can have massive unforeseen consequences down the line.
And that applies not just to deep time, but to our own lives too, right? We like to think our careers or successes are purely planned, but so much depends on chance encounters, lucky breaks, being in the right place.
Absolutely. The second big theme is the demolition of the myth of progress. Evolution isn't a ladder leading inevitably upward towards complexity or intelligence, culminating in us.
It's more like a bush.
A vastly branching bush, as Gould famously put it. And mass extinctions have pruned entire limbs of that bush quite randomly, leaving only a few surviving branches to continue diversifying.
Mm-hmm.
It fosters humility, doesn't it? We're not the pinnacle. We're just one surviving twig on this enormous contingent bush.
Definitely. Which leads to the third point. Mass extinction is a lottery. Survival isn't always about being the fittest in the traditional sense.
Right. When the asteroid hits or the climate shifts dramatically, being perfectly adapted to the old world might be useless, even detrimental. Survival can depend on traits that were previously neutral or even just geographic luck. It tells us that resilience and adaptability might be more important long term than just optimizing for current conditions.
And the fourth theme ties back to that early explosion of designs.
Disparity before diversity. The fact that the greatest range of fundamental body plans existed early and much of it was lost. This gives real urgency to modern conservation efforts. Because when we lose a species today, especially one from a unique lineage, we're not just losing diversity. We might be losing the last remnant of an entire evolutionary experiment, a branch of that bush that goes back millions, maybe hundreds of millions of years. And once it's gone, that unique blueprint is lost forever.
Gould was so good at crystallizing these ideas. Let's touch on a couple of his memorable lines from the book.
Okay. Well, the most famous one, capturing the contingency argument, has to be, "Replay the take a million times from a Burgess beginning, and I doubt that anything like Homo sapiens would ever evolve again."
That just hits you, doesn't it? Our existence isn't repeatable. It's a one-off result of a specific historical sequence. Mind-boggling, really.
Like completely. And then there's his direct challenge to the idea of progress. The history of life is a story of massive removal, followed by differentiation within a few surviving stocks, not the conventional tale of steadily increasing excellence.
It's a starker picture, less comforting maybe, but more aligned with the fossil evidence he presents.
But it's not meant to be depressing. There's a liberating aspect too, he writes. We are the offspring of history and must establish our own paths in this most diverse and interesting of conceivable universes, one ruled by contingency.
Ah, so if there's no pre-written script, no destiny.
Then we're free. We have the responsibility and the opportunity to create our own meaning and purpose. The contingency isn't a cosmic joke. It's the foundation of our freedom.
So bringing this down to earth, how can we apply these very deep time lessons to our lives today?
Well, the first application is clearly intellectual humility. Understanding our accidental arrival is a powerful antidote to human arrogance, to thinking we're the center of the universe or the ultimate goal of evolution.
It encourages a sense of stewardship, maybe. Respect for all the other results of life's lottery.
Exactly. And the story of Walcott versus the Cambridge team is a fantastic lesson in critical thinking. Walcott was brilliant, but his assumptions blinded him.
It makes you question your own assumptions, doesn't it? What obvious truths are we accepting without really examining the evidence? What are we shoehorning into our existing beliefs?
We all do it. It's a constant struggle to see past our own biases, whether in science, business, or just personal life. Gould's story is a great reminder to stay vigilant, to be willing to reconsider.
And then there's the biodiversity point again.
Yeah, understanding this deep history really underscores why biodiversity and conservation are so critical. Every species represents a unique evolutionary path, potentially millions of years old. Losing one isn't just sad, it's erasing a part of life's irreplaceable history.
Okay, as we wrap up, what's the one thing from Wonderful Life that really sticks with you?
For me, I think it's the sheer scale of that lost world. The idea that the Cambrian seas were filled with more fundamental kinds of creatures than exist now, that life's basic inventiveness peaked half a billion years ago. It's just staggering. It makes our current world feel almost diminished in a way, but also incredibly precious because it's what survived. Yeah, that's a powerful point. For me, it's the philosophical shift. It's realizing that contingency, the lack of inherent direction or purpose in our evolution, isn't a bleak thought. It's actually liberating. It replaces this burden of destiny with a sense of profound luck. We are fantastically, improbably lucky to be here. Yeah. And that feeling of fortune, of being the beneficiaries of this incredible cosmic lottery, should, I think, inspire awe and a sense of responsibility for this amazing contingent world we inherited.
A sense of wonder at the sheer improbability of it all. That's a perfect place to leave it. A truly essential deep dive into our own origins.
This really was. A classic book for a reason.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.